The first question is, regarding the point you made about the symbolic Buddhas this morning, could we therefore say, if there is no defilement, no discrimination, there will be no blocking out of the natural flow of events and forces symbolized perhaps by the Buddhas or Bodhisattvas? Oh, I beg your pardon, I'm reading it in the wrong way. There will be no blocking out of the natural flow of events and forces symbolized perhaps by the Buddhas or Bodhisattvas will come into being at different times according to conditions in the way they should. Is this more or less the point you were making? Yes. The word yes really is the whole answer practically. You see, what is it that shuts out the play of the universal through us? The play of the main archetypal forms of the primordial creative energy of the unformed, the unbecome, the unmade, and all the rest of it. What is it that shuts that out? Ourselves, the blockages in us, the veils around us. You see, to put it in rather usual form in which the Buddhist texts put it, our own defilements. You see, our mental fixations, our vices and virtues, which are partial virtue. None of our virtues are true virtue. I think we touched upon this yesterday. You see? So all this shuts out the play of these archetypal forms of the primordial energy. When the defilements in us are out, then that play becomes continuous, natural, spontaneous. The cleansing of the psyche of all defilements strengthens the psyche. At the same time, it sensitizes the psyche and the body. And that is one of the reasons why it is necessary to have a rightly trained body to stand this super energy. As we are like electric bulbs which can stand a current of 140 volts, send a current of 240 volts and we'd bust, as the child would say. You see, this is one of the main reasons why we must never play with these forces. We are often warned against the dangers of meditation and this, that and the other. We evoke these energies, and in a certain condition, because of the evocation, because of the aspiration, we sort of make a channel and that energy will come through. But is the psychophysical organism capable of standing unshattered by that energy? You see, this is one of the things we have to bear in mind. But if the body is rightly trained, which doesn't mean go in for a prize fighter's training or become a super athlete or something like that, a record breaker. But sensitize the body in the right way, which means essentially that the nervous system becomes really fit, really strong. And that, of course, depends on your food, the way you take your exercise, your rest, and also the way you function all the day, psychically and mentally. Worry, anxiety, ambition, envy, all these things are a hindrance. All worldliness, the worldly outlook, and the desire to succeed, not only in worldly matters, but in spiritual matters. That passion to succeed is an egoistic passion, you see. All that has to be cleansed. When we have really seen into ourselves, and we know, we definitely know that we are like that, the real seeing is the purgative, so to say, and all those ills are transformed in our psyche into real psychical power. There is no what we call our ills are the unfortunate forms which are taken up by our life energy. What is virtue? What is vice? Our psychophysical energy in either an appropriate, a right, a healthy form, or an inappropriate, a wrong, an unhealthy form. The unhealthy form is transformed into a healthy one. So, with the purification of the individual, this is why all the religions of the world have emphasized the moralities. The silas mean purification in the true and the supreme sense. They apply not merely to the moralistic sphere, but also to every sphere in our life. Intellectually, our purification means essentially the freeing of ourselves from bias, prejudice, preconceptions, and assumptions. Not one of our preconceptions and assumptions have any warrant in truth. And of course, we all know that our prejudices are hindrances. Then there's no need to expound that at all. And when those are out, the archetypal energies flow through and they find right expression in our daily life. And then that person is truly a helper of humanity. He is the one who spontaneously, naturally, unknowingly does good all the time to his total environment. He's free from the passion to be a do-gooder. Therefore, it just happens naturally and spontaneously. When that is the situation, it is not I or you or any particular person who is doing the good. It is transcendence itself using this particular person to let good flower out in the world and bring mankind to fruition, to true happiness, to peace. This question asks, in relation to levels of consciousness, Do you feel able to indicate what takes place when A hypnotizes B, orders B, controls B, and yet B has no memory of these acts afterwards? I'll read that again. Do you feel able to indicate what takes place when A hypnotizes B, orders B, controls B, and yet B has no memory of these acts afterwards? And B is therefore not responsible for them, though he might be considered responsible for having allowed himself to be used in this way. The question actually says, for having allowed his consciousness to be used in this way. And the second part is it good or bad? Perhaps I better tell you a little personal story. In 1935, somewhere there, I met a man who was a dentist by profession, and he considered himself a hypnotizer. And he was talking quite a lot about, oh, I can hypnotize anybody and this and that, and all the people he had hypnotized. And he looked at me and said, I can hypnotize you. So I said, all right, have a go. We'll see what happens. And he went on in his usual way, you know, now then, relax, relax. You are getting more and more sleepy. Your eyelids are drooping. You're falling asleep. He went on in this manner for about 5 minutes, getting more and more irritated. And then finally burst out, sleep, damn you, sleep. So I told him, my dear fellow, I wasn't resisting you. You were incapable. He never came to me again. Well now, this question, so to look at it seriously. When a person lets himself get hypnotized in that way, most of the controlling centers within his own, within the hypnotized one's brain, get put to sleep, excepting usually certain very deep-seated centers which deal with morality, with conscience. There may be others too. I don't know too much. I don't know very much about this. But this much I know. That which controls, maintains the moral sense, on the whole, with rare exceptions, remains untouched. But the other centers go to sleep. And it's easy enough for the hypnotist to do all these things to the hypnotized. He orders the person, he controls the person, and so forth, you see. When coming out of the hypnotic state, B has no memory of it at all. Because all that B does under the hypnotic influence, or divulges under the hypnotic influence, makes no new impress upon that brain, the hypnotized one's brain. Therefore, when he comes out of that, he has no memory of it at all. It is as if, in this instance, B went off into a dead faint. If A were to order B to murder somebody or do something terrifically dreadful, and assuming that B had the sort of normal moral sense of a citizen, he would be able to resist that, and he would not do it. But otherwise, he will do almost anything apart from something very, very deep and very, very serious. So, being in a sort of a dead faint, there is no memory about that period and whatever was done or said or happened. You know how under anesthetics in operations, people blurt out all kinds of things about themselves, which if used as evidence against them would necessitate a complete sentence, a total sentence, which is in one American case just recently meant 147 years in prison or something, which is of course an impossibility. Simplest thing is to hang him, but here we are. You see, it would mean something as serious as that. So, this dead faint is a state which, when you recover from this state, there is no memory at all. With my illness last March, and I went off into a dead faint twice in succession with the loss of blood, within a few minutes, and it was a really dead faint. I have absolutely no memory of just those two periods, and then only vague memories of what happened for the practically the rest of that day. Confused memories, you see. And I know that in the case of my elder son, when he was with his younger brother riding up on his bicycle up Porlock Hill near Minehead, he suddenly collapsed and had to be taken to hospital. And they performed an operation on him using, I think, pentothal as the anesthetic. It was touch and go whether he'd recover, because when the operation was performed, that pentothal actually killed him off. For 3.5 minutes, his heart had stopped. The surgeon was very skillful. They immediately cut open, injected adrenaline, and massaged the heart, and brought him back to life, you see. But the thing was so serious that twice in succession, it happened at about 11 o'clock in the morning on a Good Friday, and twice in succession before lunch they had to call the specialist from Taunton to Minehead. He was in Minehead Hospital, and his breathing stopped twice, you see, before then, and set him off again. Well, my wife and I, of course, drove down on a beautiful, sunny Good Friday day, which was a day which I trust not only I, but no one else will ever know, that kind of thing. It was terrific, the reality of death there. And I know my wife's hair went grey a little bit by the morning. And I took months to recover from that shock. It took me 18 months to be able to stand up and give an impromptu talk again for an hour. 18 months before I could do it. So you see how severe these shocks can be. Well, we were there in a hotel just next to the hospital, and we reached Minehead by 8 o'clock in the evening. And I looked at that boy, you know, on that bed, just like that, all the usual paraphernalia. And I felt he'll be all right. I just felt that. Quite irrational feeling, because the surgeon told Sylvia, and she being a doctor, he did tell her the truth, which they wouldn't divulge to me, that it's touch and go. If the boy survives 24 hours, well, he will possibly turn out like a Mongol afterwards for the rest of his days, and certainly his brilliance of brain will not be there. And for examinations and future career, you can more or less take it for granted, so that if I tell you, you're prepared for it, that it won't turn out what you could expect of him. He was one of these first-class honors people, you see, and that sort of thing. At midnight, that boy woke up suddenly, opened his eyes. I didn't go to sleep that night. I kept vigil by him all the time. Of course, I didn't merely look at him. I was also active. He opened his eyes. They were brilliant as ever. And I was absolutely certain he'll be perfectly all right. At 5 o'clock in the morning, Sylvia came from the hospital, and the surgeon also came, and he looked at him, looked at the boy, performed one or two tests, the usual sort of tests, and the reactions of his body went the right way this time instead of the wrong way. You know, they tickle you under the with a feather underneath your feet and so on, and what is it, instead of going that way or which way, it went the other way as usual. And he said, well, this is good. And suddenly that surgeon looked at me, just curious look, and then he said, I think you can now go to bed. Said it very meaningfully. He was a very religious-minded man. They always sort of had prayers and so forth before they performed an operation. Curious. And so that was Saturday morning. And the thing he asked me when he woke up that midnight and he opened his eyes, he said, where's my penknife? Where's my penknife? And he wanted to put his trousers on and so forth. I said, just sleep quietly, John. It's Dad here. Just sleep quietly. And in a few minutes, he went off to sleep again. On Sunday morning, the Sunday after Good Friday, the surgeon came in. And he said, definitely, this is a miracle. But he warned, don't let him strain his brain. He must stay away from Dulwich College. He was the sixth form then, for the whole of this term, and certainly not sit for his, what was it? It was his O-level or A-levels, I think. Well, within 6 weeks, John was so fidgety at home that he went back. And was doing his work as usual. By the way, on Sunday morning, that Sunday morning when he woke up, he started talking with me. We were talking about Einstein's relativity and certain mathematical things. And my wife finally stopped me and said, "For goodness sake, Feroz, don't trouble him, don't try him," you see. So I shut up, of course. That was that. He sat for the exam and did more brilliantly than ever. But he has no memory at all to this day of that riding up Porlock Hill near Minehead and the collapse and the recovery on Sunday and then for just a few days afterwards. It's all absolutely out of his mind. It also killed off some other memories of his young days about his grandfather, Sylvia's father, and the contact with him and so forth. He couldn't, I think to this day, John can't visualize what his grandfather was like. Mind you, John was 16 then when this happened. So it gives you an idea of what this dead faint means, this complete wiping out of the memory. Apparently the brain, possibly the brain cells, some of the brain cells do get destroyed. The ones which hold these memory patterns, they get completely destroyed. So one is completely irresponsible in that state. And maybe that in this case of hypnosis, this is what happens. Something like it happens, excepting that probably no brain cells are killed off by the hypnotist. But it might be that no impression, therefore, is left on the brain cells in B's head. That's all I can say about it. And is it good or bad? I should say, keep every hypnotist at arm's length.
Is it literally a simple matter, though, Feroz?
Pardon?
Is it a simple matter of just counting to five and your eyes are getting sleepy and tired? Is that all that a hypnotist does to one? Can you go?
I don't know what on earth he does.
No,
I've had rather a sort of a. You know, that kind of attitude towards hypnotists. I think that's a good deal of la-di-da about it. Mind you, the person who isn't strong in his own mind, in proper control of himself, is liable to be hypnotized that way. But hypnotism does play, nowadays, I'm told, a helpful part in healing certain conditions. They use narcotics, though, as an assistant for putting that person for putting him into such a condition that he can be hypnotized. But you see, under extreme conditions, all right, let yourself be hypnotized, provided you can trust the other person's goodness and skill.
It's generally reckoned medically that if they don't get a heart to start within 3 minutes, brain damage occurs.
If they don't what?
If they don't get the heart to restart within 3 minutes, brain damage occurs.
In the case of death?
Well, in the case of a sudden stoppage of the heart.
Ah, yes, yes.
It must be restarted within 3 minutes.
Yes, 3 minutes is the safe sort of limit.
Yes.
But John has not shown the slightest sign of any deterioration physically or mentally. He's had quite a brilliant career all along. He's 37 now, you see, and holding a pretty high executive position in ICI in America. As a matter of fact, he was seconded from here because he had done so well here. The Americans wanted him, you see. They selected him out of so many that were put out by ICI as possible candidates.
Wasn't it strange it should happen at Easter on Good Friday, the resurrection on the Sunday?
No.
3 days.
It was really a resurrection. Now, please will you tell us, and you know this illness I had in March was also at Easter. Exactly 21 years later. No, wait a minute. In 1978 we are. That was 1957, yes. Exactly 21 years later. Please will you tell us something about the part love or transcendence plays when we take a step in that direction. You say it is non-compulsive, that is, that transcendence is non-compulsive. Yet once we make the first move, does it not come towards us? Transcendence come towards us as the father ran to meet the prodigal son in the parable. Is this what is meant by the Christian term, the grace of God? And is there a Buddhist name for this? Oh, thinking of this last part of the question, I don't know. Is there anybody who knows? Is there a Buddhist name? The Sanskrit word is prasada, meaning grace. But whether there is a specific Buddhist teaching about that kind, just precisely that kind of thing to which grace, the word grace applies, I don't know.
No.
Not karuna. Karuna is just compassion as such, you see.
Darshan.
Spell it.
Darshan.
D-A-R-S-A-N-A. No, darshana means a showing, a demonstration. You see, if you, when the queen comes to the balcony at Buckingham Palace, that is a darshana to the populace.
Doesn't grace mean something given freely?
Oh, well, of course, yes, yes. Yes, but I don't know the Buddhist, if there is a Buddhist...
don't think so.
In Tibetan, a lama is supposed to have this grace-giving. Like Marpa to Milarepa.
Yes. And they talk of when you go into meditation or something, to ask for the grace waves from the teacher whom you visualize. That's it. But is there a Buddhist name for this? A specific name? There must be, but I don't know. I'm sorry. Now, let's deal with the question as such. Good Lord, how time flies. Something about the part love or transcendence plays when we take one step in that direction. You know the good old saying, which is a true saying, if we take one step towards God, transcendence, call the Buddha, holiness, call it what you like, that power takes 7 steps towards us. Or 70, as the case may be.
Say God helps them.
You see,
themselves.
Yes. You see, the thing is this: that if you or I do one thing which is really in line with the trends of life. You see, the response which we become sensitive to and we become aware of is immensely greater in quality, in quantity, than what we have done towards it. You see? This is always the case. How? Why? Our energy is a limited something. The energy of transcendence is inexhaustible. And we let loose upon ourselves that beneficence which comes from that which is transcendent. And love has been written here with a capital L, you see, like transcendence with a capital T, meaning love in its transcendent reality. We release archetypal energies which are universally operating and universally operative always. We get the response from them. You know, it is it's rather a very mundane simile. You know, if you have a large party and you've got an enormous tea urn and your waitress is serving at speed, she will often overspill the cup which is held up to her, won't she? It is like that. This huge urn, you see, the pressure is so great that it overspills. And it is yours. Now, grace as a reality, as a very real energy, is everlastingly present throughout the universe. We shut it out because of our ignorance. Because we are still unaware of this true relationship between ourselves and that which is the all-beneficent, the all-giving. Otherwise it is everlastingly there for anybody and everybody in every shape and form. And it is not exclusive to anyone who belongs to any particular faith or through his particular master. It is freely available, just as you go out into the fresh air, open air in the open country, and nobody will hinder or say nay to your breathing the air of heaven itself. See, grace is like that, and grace is a very real energy and a very real power. It's one of the very beautiful teachings in the great religions of the world. This beneficence, this divine love, which cleanses, which bears no ill will, which does not think in terms of retribution against any individual, forbears with us, infinite forbearance, infinite patience, and it waits and it waits till we open the doors and windows of our own hearts and minds, and lo and behold, it just comes flooding in, just like a brilliantly sunny day. You just have to draw the curtains and there your room is flooded with sunshine. You just have to open the door and the fresh, clean, health-giving, pure air comes in and you can breathe. It's like that. That is the real nature of the universe in relationship to us. Our task is just to let the curtains be drawn and the doors opened. And that we do essentially by turning our attention towards the transcendent. That is all. Supposing your dearest beloved stands at the door, but you don't turn your attention to the fact that somebody is knocking at the door, you will shut out the dearest beloved. Grace is like that.
It's known in the Psalms as grace abounding.
And the beloved is not going to break down your doors. Never will. A bit too expensive to start with.